The following lecture is under copyright by Reformation Christian Ministries and is for your personal use only. It is not to be copied or otherwise distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. Contact information will be provided at the end of this lecture.
This is Modern Church Lecture 3. You'll remember that in the last lecture we were talking about the Westminster Assembly, which was called by the Long Parliament to discuss the government of the church. We talked about its meeting in Westminster Abbey and the Jerusalem Chamber. We talked about its makeup and so on. And we said that in 1644, it met first in 1643, and then in 1644, it adopted the Solemn League and Covenant, and we talked about that and sought to impose that upon all Englishmen. And one of the things that it did was outlaw rule by episcopacy, that is, by bishops and leaders of the church rather than by councils, and it also abolished the use of the Book of Common Prayer. We turn now to the theological work of the Westminster Assembly, which it moved into after it dealt with church government to some extent. Now, what's interesting is that it never did produce a directory of worship or church, a directory of church government that was adopted by the Parliament, because there were always differences with Scotland and so on. But the theological work of the assembly begins in earnest in the summer of 1644, and the Scottish treaty addressers, as they were called, were added to the Westminster Assembly as advisory members. They had come from Scotland, and now they served also as a part of the Westminster Assembly, even though they were not full members in the sense that they were allowed to vote. As I said, the Assembly was perhaps least successful in the matter of church government. It had established some ideas about the directory of worship or about the worship of the church, but now when it came to church government, it was perhaps least effective in what it did. And the reason for that is that it tried to encourage Presbyterianism. It passed a directory of church government or a form of government that was Presbyterian, that pretty much followed the way that the Scots had been governing their church for the last 50 or 100 years, and that was not suitable for the Parliament. The Parliament always refused to adopt it. It first set up a directory of ordination on the 14th of April in 1844, and that failed. Later on, it set up in fall. It sent up propositions concerning church government, and these also were rejected. And there are several reasons for that. One is that the Scots themselves had a very broad idea of the powers of a local session, and they were very loath to give these up to a presbytery or to a general assembly. The idea being that the session was the most powerful assembly in the church. And so that there were those among the Scots as well as among the British, or the English, I should say, who were not interested in the assemblies of presbyteries and general assembly of the whole church as being a very powerful councils. There were also some very able independents in Parliament at this time, and they were opposed to Presbyterianism under any circumstances. They simply would not vote for any kind of a Presbyterian approach to church government. The independents, of course, and we'll look at them a little bit later on, because we're going to try to take a fairly thorough look at the various theological currents in England in later lectures. But the independents had the idea that each Christian stood with a relationship to God personally, and that was all that he needed, and that a relationship to a congregation was not that important. It kind of fits in with the modern idea today that Christianity is between me and God, and there really isn't a great deal of importance to actual church membership. And even those who consider church membership very important, as some of the Congregationalists did, the Puritan Congregationalists at the time that the Westminster Assembly was meeting, for them, the broader assemblies were simply advisory. They didn't really have any power from God, and certainly could not direct or rule over local churches in any way. And so Presbyterianism just didn't get enough votes is basically what happened. So the assembly then turned basically to the work of theology, of a theological kind, and produced the Westminster Confession in about a year and a half. Now, we do need to say that in the summer of 1645, a practical directory for church government came very close to being ratified by the Parliament, but it never did reach final passage. At the same time, what we would call a presbytery or classis, there were several of these organized in parts of London, especially in London and Lancashire. There were some classes. So that was an approach to Presbyterianism in England. But these classes, the plural of classis, by the way, which is the continental word for presbytery, meaning the gathering of the elders of a broader area than a local church, only lasted a couple of years because, of course, there was simply so much unrest in England during the time of the ascendancy of Oliver Cromwell and the Republic, the Commonwealth, as it was called, that these things didn't last long. There was, however, in 1645, a directory of worship that was adopted. This removed the Scottish opening of the service by a reader, something that was very common on the continent, but it also contained no set prayers. There were no prayers that were to be read from the book. Those were to be free prayers. Private baptisms were outlawed by this directory of public worship. Communicants at the Lord's Supper seemed to be seated for the Lord's Supper. No festivals of the church year were allowed, and it included also a revision of the metrical Psalter, which had been transmitted from the continent and had been used in England. And so it did have some very positive effects on worship in the Anglican Church in England, even though it showed a great deal of Puritan influence in that, as I say, there were no set prayers, there were no festivals of the church year. Easter and Christmas and those things were not allowed, which is a very popular position among Puritans. Well, they went on then with their theological work, and that really is a study in itself, actually, and we won't spend a lot of time with that in this course, hoping that you might, in some of the readings that we have assigned, pick up on that. We could spend a good deal of time on the various theological discussions and so on. But it needs to be noted that among those who took part in this theological work, the various committees that were set up to study various aspects, the Puritans and the Congregationalists, some of them, of course, were the same people. The Anglicans, by and large, who were involved, because the Anglicans who were involved in the Westminster Assembly were what we would call low church. They were not very much in the direction of Roman Catholic ideas. They were all Calvinists, and they were all quite agreed on quite a number of issues, as can be seen in the Westminster Confession, which turned out to be a very excellent confession of faith. Well, it was adopted by the Assembly in 1647, and in 1649 it was adopted by the Scottish Parliament. And later on, or I should say in the summer of 1648, however, the English Parliament added the civil magistrate's power to call the assemblies of the church and so on, which was quite different from what the Assembly itself had in mind, because the Assembly itself had in mind a church that was operated by its own elders and ministers as commissioners to various meetings, to presbyteries and to assemblies. And yet the English Parliament added those ideas, and it's hard to say whether the Parliament actually adopted the whole confession or not. It seems to have added these things concerning the assemblies being called by the government, and then seems to have let the thing die. But in any case, the Westminster Assembly continued to work on the catechisms, and one of them, the larger catechism, was made to be expounded by the preachers in the worship services, and the shorter catechism was made to teach the people the Christian faith. And so the Westminster Assembly, in spite of the difficulties under which it operated, in spite of the differences of opinion about church government and even about worship, about which its conclusions were more negative than positive, did produce a tremendous confession and teaching instruments in the catechisms, the larger and shorter catechism. And so the Westminster Assembly has to stand out as one of the great assemblies of Christian divines in history, and certainly the product, the Westminster Confession and the Westminster Larger and Shorter Catechism, are still today the confessions of Scottish and Presbyterian churches all over the world. And we are not to belittle that, because it was a tremendous product of work as I say, in spite of, or perhaps because of, to some extent, the situation in England at the time and the difficulty that the Assembly had getting its work approved by Parliament. And, of course, that is in itself a problem, because we, perhaps looking back from the 20th century, would say, why should the Parliament have to approve the work of a religious assembly, what eventually became basically a national synod, in a sense, of the English church? And yet the idea of a state church had certainly not died out in England. And, for example, Oliver Cromwell himself, even though his thinking was much more along Congregationalist Puritan lines, still believed that England should have a state church, but that there should be freedom of religion for all except a few of the more radical sects, religious sects that were in operation, and we'll be looking at some of them a little bit later on. Well, we move now to the next section in our discussion of the situation in England and look at Cromwell's rule. We've already mentioned that Cromwell had been successful militarily, and that he had driven the King of England, Charles I, to flee to Scotland, where he had been arrested by the Scottish army and was in their hands. And so Charles I, nevertheless, is still alive and is still trying to work behind the scenes to get some of his ideas and to get the Anglican Church, the English Church, to be far less Reformed and Presbyterian than Cromwell would have liked to have seen. And so he continued, in a sense, to be a threat on the horizon, even though he was under house arrest. Now, the Scots tried to make a Presbyterian out of him, but they failed in that because Charles really was a Roman Catholic. Now, he didn't hold to the power of Rome, but his ideas concerning the church and its worship and the rulership, the government of the church, were very, very much in line with Roman teaching. And at the same time, we have to recognize that he considered the Anglican Church, the Church of England, a better expression of old Catholic teaching than he did the Church at Rome. So he did have some differences with the Church of Rome. Well, in any case, the army now entered London. The Republican army, led by Cromwell, entered London because of the resistance of the Parliament to the King, and the King refused to give up episcopacy, and so they entered London to back up the Parliament, and they did that in 1647 while the Westminster Assembly was going on and while the Long Parliament was in operation. Now, what had happened, of course, is that Cromwell had been victorious on the battlefield, and yet the government of England had not been replaced. The Parliament was still in session, but the Parliament was not an executive branch of government. It was a legislative branch, and it had no experience in administrative affairs and that kind of thing. And so Cromwell eventually becomes the Lord Protector of England, and some people wanted to make him king even, but he didn't want to do that, and he became the Lord Protector of England simply to fill the power vacuum that was left by the flight of Charles I. So eventually, finally, Cromwell had to fight with the Scottish army too and overcome the Scots, and eventually he established the government of his government over all of Britain, not just over England, but all of Britain, and he literally in 1650 becomes the dictator of all of Britain. Now, that had some interesting results, as we will also see in just a bit. But after he had defeated the Scots, he expelled the Presbyterians of the Rump Parliament of Independence that was meeting. That was called Pride's Purge. There were a group of people who set up their own parliament in competition with the Long Parliament, and he expelled them, and then he got the Scots to Scottish army to give up Charles I, and he was executed in January of 1649. By the way, Cromwell also, at about the same time, dissolved the House of Lords. So England came under the complete control of Oliver Cromwell and the House of Commons, and that was quite a revolution. I think we would be able to recognize even from this distance. And I mentioned earlier that there are still some leftovers of the difference of opinion about whether that was good or bad in England today. Well, in any case, Cromwell becomes captures Edinburgh in 1650 and becomes the dictator of all of Britain, all of the island of Britain, and ruled also as well as can be done from the island, Ireland as well. Now, the results of that were rather interesting because, of course, the Scots now had to have been defeated by Cromwell's army were now really opposed to Cromwell, and they were pushed into the arms of the house of Charles I, the Stuarts. And so while Cromwell also tried to negotiate with Charles II to get him to come back as a kind of a captive king, a king who would submit to the ideas of the Republicans of the Commonwealth, they never were able to do that. But anyway, the Scottish Presbyterians then were divided into two groups, those who favored Charles II, who now wanted to reinstate the authority of those who had supported Charles I as officers, and of course this was not allowed under the Commonwealth, and the protesters, as they were called, who considered it good that Cromwell had taken over Scotland as well as England, and now they wanted that government to continue. And so we leave this now for a while, remembering that Cromwell is in charge of England, and we will come back in about 10 years to the reinstatement of the kingdom under the Stuarts, under Charles II. We would like to switch now from looking at the political and specifically ecclesiastical developments in England to a look at some of the things that were going on scientific, socially, in the same period of time, because I think we can't really understand the political and the ecclesiastical developments unless we realize that this is a tremendously productive age as far as the thinking of mankind is concerned. In fact, Paul Woolley at Westminster Seminary years ago pointed out to the 17th century as comparable to the 4th and 5th centuries, a revolution in human thinking that came in those days concerning the theology of Augustine and the relationship of church and state when Constantine became the emperor and took over the Christian church by approving it, by having the Roman state approve the approve Christianity, in a sense, not quite as the official religion. But that was a watershed. That was a beginning of a tremendous change in the life of the church and in the life of the state. Well, there are certain things that we need to understand. Growing out of the Protestant Reformation, there was a tremendous growth alongside of it of humanism, of the study of various aspects, and humanistic studies included not only the Bible and some of the ancient writings, but it produced a tremendous scientific revolution as well. And this is something that was moving along already in England before the time of the blossom of the Renaissance in Italy. And that was a tentative move toward scientific thinking in the modern sense of the word. And so much of what we think as the modern day kind of science and social relationships and so on were things that, and nationalism, by the way, the centering of a nation's hopes and life on itself rather than on a Roman government far away and a pope far away. Those are the kinds of things that came out of the Reformation. The Reformation, of course, did a lot positive with respect to that, but of course it didn't do anything, do everything, I should say. It brought the church much closer to Scripture, and so theology experienced a revolution in becoming a scriptural theology rather than a traditional theology or a theology that was developed out of the needs of the Roman Catholic papacy, and that was a tremendous step forward. Certainly the individual in the pew, the common man, received a great deal of information about life, about the Bible, about God, about his own salvation and his own Savior, which made him a completely different person. He was no longer a totally ignorant slave of an ecclesiastical and a feudal economic system, but he became someone who could think for himself and who recognized that his own faith is what made the difference in his eternal salvation, and that his own life had meaning because he was here as a servant of God above all things. That doctrine of the priesthood of all believers that Martin Luther promulgated and which was taken up by the rest of the Protestant churches is very important to this, so that we need to recognize our place as our place in society and in life growing out of the revolutionary ideas of the Protestant Reformation. At the same time, there were some things which we can perhaps criticize or look back upon and recognize as being things that the Reformation did not bring and which might have been helpful. For example, not even in particular countries was there a unified church. There was a state church in many countries in Europe, certainly in those countries which were still in the hands of the Roman Catholics, such as Italy and Spain and France. Nevertheless, even in Germany and the Netherlands and some of the other countries, Denmark and Norway and Sweden and England, even though you had a state church, it was not really a unified church that you could say that everybody in the country held to the same theology. There were always sects which were not connected with the state church, and the state church, of course, tended to a kind of nominalism, that is, a Christianity in name only. That was very deadly to real, true Christianity. And so the Protestant church still was somewhat fragmented across Europe and has never gained the kind of unity that the Roman Catholic Church had before the Reformation. There was, we could say, the principles of Scripture were probably not applied as well as they might have been both in church and in state. That developed not nationally in the subsequent history, but that developed as churches really pulled away from the state, so that as churches were forced to, or by choice, became independent of national governments, they were more able to consistently apply the principles of Scripture to the life of the Christian and to the life of the church and to the government of the church. So there were some things which were missing in the Reformation. While there was some interest in bringing the gospel to people in the new lands which were being discovered, particularly in North America and in South America, there was not a concerted understanding of missions, of foreign missions, as the work of the church. It should be said in defense of the churches, however, that John Calvin was interested in the religious state of people in these new lands that were being discovered during the time of the Reformation, and that, for example, the Dutch Reformed government in Holland required the Dutch East India Company to send a pastor or a missionary along with every colony that it established in the foreign countries. And one of the jobs of that pastor was not only to begin or to provide church services for the Dutch people who were there, but also to seek in some fashion to bring the gospel to the native peoples of the lands. So the idea of missions was not missing, but it certainly was not something that was taken as seriously and perhaps not in as organized a fashion as it might have been. There were also developing during this time the great colonial empires, and we might question the way that the Europeans went about their colonialism. I think the discovery of new lands was a natural aspect of Christians subduing the earth, but their treatment of the native peoples was often very paternalistic, and the result was not generally good for the native peoples, unfortunately. Even when they brought an end to tribal warfare, as they did in Africa, in the colonies of the European nations in Africa, and even though they built a fairly modern infrastructure that provided a lot better life for the native peoples, there was still a paternalistic attitude, so that in the 20th century, when these colonies were broken away from their colonial masters, the people themselves did not actually have the skills to run their countries. And so countries like Zaire today and many of the other countries in South in Africa, I should say, not just in South Africa, but in Africa, have turned back to tribal warfare. And that's, of course, what's going to happen, it seems to me, in South Africa, a nation which was not only colonized, but actually was inhabited, first of all, by people from Europe. There weren't many of the African natives in Southern Africa because it was not that hospitable a land for them. They were hunter-gatherers, and the pickings for hunter-gatherers were much better in the middle of Africa than in Southern Africa. And so the black people that are in South Africa today have actually emigrated there from the central parts of Africa. And what has happened is that there are great colonies of those different tribal groups in Southern Africa. And as the government, yes, it was a racial government, and we certainly don't want to agree with that, yet the result of taking away the organization that was established by the South African government, which was led by the white people, is sinking into some tribal warfare and that kind of thing, which is not, which is really a kind of a primitive situation. It goes along with my contention made at the beginning of this course that what produces primitivism is not ancient time or not enough time elapsed among peoples, because, of course, the people in Africa have been there just as long as the white people have been in Europe. The difference is that Europe got converted to Christianity, and that Christianity had a tremendous revolution for the good through the Protestant Reformation. And it's only that kind of a thing which will elevate people to a higher standard of living physically, but even more to a higher spiritual and social standard of living. And that's what makes civilization, it seems to me. Well, we want to turn now to the fact that nationalism began to grow. There were people who began to now look at nations as being separate, and the most important characteristic of life became our relationship to the nation in which we live, rather than to the church. And I think we see that that is a revolution in thinking, and it's one that has had some good effects, I guess we'd have to say, because before that, most of Europe was subject to the Roman papacy, and the Roman popes generally called for the subjection of civil government to themselves, saying that the Pope is Christ's vicar on earth, and therefore he has the highest authority rather than the national government. Now we see, proceeding from what happened in the Reformation, a separation of church and state, in the sense that the state does not rule the church and the church does not rule the state. It's certainly biblical for the church not to rule the state. And yet we also see that the states generally, including in the modified Westminster Confession as modified by the Parliament, the state still had a great deal of influence in the church. Well, the point is that all of this led to a kind of nationalism in which various nations began to compete with each other, so that you have the tremendous building of fleets of ships by the Spanish and the English and the French and the Dutch. And this led to a great deal of difference as to the success of the nation. The Dutch, because they had a tremendous fleet of merchant ships and were successful militarily on the seas of the world, had an influence and had a wealth that was far greater than the size of their little nation might indicate. And as I said earlier, the Dutch call this 17th century the Golden Age. Some of the thinkers that were talking about the political aspects of life were Thomas Hobbes, who lived from 1588 to 1679. You see, right in the middle of his life, the revolution happened in England and the taking over of the British Commonwealth. And Hobbes himself was one who encouraged and wrote in favor of the British Commonwealth. So did Locke, John Locke, the British philosopher, later in his life. And so this had an effect on philosophy, just as philosophy had an effect upon the nationalism of the age. Perhaps the greatest revolution that happened during the 17th century was what we would think of as a scientific revolution, a revolution in natural science. There was tremendous progress in natural science, an emphasis on observation of the events themselves and of the processes in nature themselves in order to understand what was happening. It seems almost strange to us and foreign to think of having science without these kinds of things. And yet the early Greek philosophers, Plato and Aristotle and some of the other great men of history were physicians spoke a great deal about natural processes, particularly about man and medicine, without ever opening a human body up to see what's going on inside. And of course, it was not until people were willing to take a dead body and cut it apart and see what was inside of it that they began to understand that there really is something going on here that was not even dreamed of. For example, a man by the name of Harvey in England discovered the blood circulation, the actual circulation of blood through the heart to the various parts of the body, and then back through the veins to the heart, which seems to us such an elementary thing, and yet that was not discovered until the 17th century. All of this goes back to the idea of observation, and Francis Bacon, who was a follower of Copernicus, came up with a lot of these ideas. It's interesting to think of the dates now. Copernicus actually lived in the 16th century, died in 1543, but he was the man who had the idea that the Earth is not the physical center of the universe, but that with the other planets, the Earth revolves around the Sun. And the great British astronomer, Kepler, who lived from 1571, you see, just about later than the death of Copernicus, yet accepted the Copernican view of the solar system. He died in 1630, and he actually was able to write laws and make mathematical formulas for the motion of the planets, which is really fantastic when you think of the instruments that those people had. The telescope was in its tremendous infancy at that time. There wasn't much use of it, much less to be able to figure out when a particular planet would rise and fall and what its relationship to the motion of the Earth is. And I think anybody who thinks that that's a simple kind of thing just needs to look up into the sky at night, see the thousands of stars that are viewable to the naked eye, and then try to make a map of the heavens, and then try to figure out just exactly what those various stars are doing in relationship to each other. Well, Galileo had recognized that the planets move differently than the stars, and Kepler actually worked out the laws of planetary motion, which I think, in considering that he did that at about 1610, is really a fantastic mental achievement. Another man who lived during this century, actually lived into the 18th century, but he was born in 1642, is Isaac Newton, died in 1727. And he was a very devout Christian. There is a modern biography of Newton, which is named In the Presence of the Creator. And that's a very interesting book, but the title tells you that Newton did his scientific mathematical work as a Christian enterprise. And he looked at himself as showing forth the glories of the Creator. And this is something that we need to see as very much a part of this early natural science revolution. And that is that most of these people were very sincere Christians. They weren't always appreciated by the church because they had some ideas that were quite different from what the church had held, and not as major doctrines, but as minor doctrines. For example, the idea of the earth as a globe, or the idea of the earth revolving around the sun, was very radical for those days. I think we need, as Christians, to recognize that spiritually the earth is the center of the universe, in the sense that God's purposes for the universe center on the planet Earth. It's very clear from the scriptures that this is the case, and there are some indications of that even in the astronomical study of the universe. We realize that all of the universe is expanding away from the Earth, which is a rather strange thing, so that when we look up or down or right or left across the universe from Earth, we see the farther things are away, the faster they are moving away from the Earth. And so it seems, in some sense, even physically, the Earth is the center of the universe from the point of view of what is happening to the rest of the universe. Nevertheless, that is not to deny that the Earth physically revolves around the sun. That is for the good of the Earth. Some years ago, I took a magazine. I should mention that I was trained in college as an engineer. I was a chemical process engineer by training, and when I left college at the University of California years ago, that was in 1960, I worked in a cancer research group for about a year and learned a great deal of biochemistry, which was in its infancy in those days, and I was very impressed with quite a number of things, of course, in the history of science. And one of the things that impressed me is some of the things that were done in the 17th century. And I remember reading an article in a magazine about the fortunate coincidences that make life on Earth possible, how Earth has so many strange things about it that seem to be designed to carry on life and to support life, even though the person who wrote the article was an evolutionist and thought that this all came by chance. He could not be struck, he could not miss being struck by the fact that this all seemed to be designed this way. Well, of course, as a Christian, I would simply say that's pretty obvious. And so the distance of the Earth from the sun, the temperature of the sun as a star, the kind of atmosphere that the Earth has, the fact that water expands when it freezes and expands when it's heated. Water has its smallest volume when it is at its freezing temperature, which is not common among the other elements, or among the other compounds, I should say, because water is a compound of hydrogen and oxygen. But anyway, water is a very strange material when compared with all the other materials in the universe, because they all keep right on expanding as you heat them up. And when they turn from solid to liquid, they keep on expanding. Yet water expands also when it's frozen, when it becomes a solid. And without that, their life would not be possible on Earth. And so many things like that are what this man called strange coincidences or lucky coincidences, I think was one of the phrases that he used. And yet, the earth is designed. And so, as the Bible says, what is man that you are mindful of him, David says in Psalm 8. And that also refers to that God has made a world for man to live in that is hospitable to man. Because everything else we see in the universe is totally inhospitable to life as we know it. Well, I want to say something about Isaac Newton, because he has to rate among the greatest minds in history. Isaac Newton invented calculus, and calculus is a rather complex form of mathematical analysis of motion that is the great key to much of modern science, whether we're talking about chemistry or astronomy or physics. Without calculus, these sciences as we know them today would be absolutely impossible. And Isaac Newton intuitively figured out calculus, figured out the relationship of mathematical formulas to each other in a way that is literally amazing. I found calculus difficult to learn, not totally difficult. I think most anyone that has a fairly decent mind can learn calculus. But as I learned calculus, I learned to appreciate the mind that came up with calculus simply from watching the motion of things on Earth and working out various laws of the relationship of motion and forces and that kind of thing. And so I think we have to understand that there was a tremendous revolution in natural science in the 17th century that probably has never been approached since or before. And I think that's a part of the picture that we're looking at here of what came out of the Reformation, the freedom for people to think in terms that allow their minds to really observe nature and to come to conclusions simply on the basis of the observation. And they did that, as I say, to the glory of God. And I pointed out that Francis Bacon, an Englishman who lived from 1561 to 1626, was one of the leaders in that idea of learning about the world from observation. And by the way, that goes back to the university at Oxford. The Franciscans at Oxford were at the heart of this kind of thinking, and there was a forerunner of Bacon by the name of Grota Testa, who was also a great part of this revolution in human science. Well, there was a social revolution as a result of the Reformation, and that certainly was taking place in England as well as in other countries. The upper classes were losing more and more of their power and their wealth, and therefore their influence. The middle class of farmers and of business people, of people who were manufacturing things on a small scale, was a growing power in society. In fact, it might be possible to say that without this growing middle class of people who were able to support themselves by the work of their hands and the sweat of their brow, independent of the rulers of the church and of the nation, there wouldn't have been a Protestant Reformation, and certainly the results would have been far different if there had. And so we can see that there were individual political and religious leaders who can say things, who can argue on the basis of logic and not be overthrown by authority that simply squashes them like a bug. So there was a great freedom of expression, which too is available during this century. Yes, people were put in prison for saying things. John Bunyan, during this century, wrote Pilgrim's Progress while he was imprisoned for preaching against the law. That was during the time of the Stuart Restoration in the latter half of the 17th century. And yet he wrote it. He was able to think these thoughts and to describe the pilgrimage of the Christian in the way that he did. Well, this was a great revolution. And so what you had during this century was not the elimination of religion as we have in the 20th century, but indeed a turning to science as a new source of truth. Eventually, technology, as we know it today, substituted for religion, and we have, of course, tremendously bad social consequences of that. So technology and science, natural science, should really simply be servants by which man serves God better. And we should use these things. We should not be afraid of, it seems to me, going to the moon and subduing the universe and using fertilizer and using bug killers, pesticides on our crops and so on. Any of these things, of course, can be overdone. But we should not be afraid of using these things in the service of God. It's only now as we come to the end of the 19th or the 20th century, and we see the results now of a century of turning away from God for truth and actually substituting science as a basis for truth, that we have produced the tremendously bad results we see in the society around us. Well, we begin going back now to the life of England, and I think we'll wait for that for the next lecture.
This lecture is copyrighted by Reformation Christian Ministries, the parent organization of Reformation International Theological Seminary and Reformation International College. This audio lecture is protected under international copyright law and is not to be copied, distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. You may contact Reformation Christian Ministries through our website at www.reformation.edu. Reformation is spelled R-E-F-O-R-M-A-T-I-O-N. By email, you can also contact us at president@reformation.edu. By phone in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8030. By fax in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8010. Or by writing to Reformation Christian Ministries, 13950 122 Street, Fellsmere, Florida, 32948 in the USA.